From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On this week's show, local lawmakers are trying to prevent the use of Sharia law here. We look into what that really means.
So if we were to say that I'm not following Sharia, we are essentially saying that we are not Muslims.
A new documentary tells the story of Kansas City's first African-American political organization, Freedom Incorporated.
A lot of people are living in an era where they see a black mayor and they don't know the struggles that it took to get him elected.
Plus, food critic Charles Ferruza talks about the days before he reviewed restaurants when he actually worked in them.
I have found in my 54 years that a little humiliation, like a dash of nutmeg in egg custard, is a good thing.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
In the last year, a movement to limit or outlaw Sharia, or Islamic law, has been gaining momentum in the U.S. Legislators in more than 20 states, including Kansas and Missouri, have introduced new laws they say are needed to prevent the spread of fundamentalist Islam. And many of the Republican presidential candidates have spoken out in favor of these laws. According to critics, however, these efforts are anti-Muslim. In the past couple of months, these critics have been working to change the tide in the Sharia debate. Alex Smith has the story.
Just after an early evening prayer service at the Islamic Center in Olathe, most of the members of the mosque have already gone home to eat dinner with their families. But Riaz Larif has something else on his mind. During the last year, he's watched anxiously as state legislatures around the country consider laws that would ban courts from enforcing Sharia. Larif says these laws are misguided, and the public needs to understand Sharia is central to the life of being a Muslim.
Without Sharia, Islam is not possible, because Sharia includes believing in the one God. Sharia includes believing in Prophet Muhammad, Prophet Jesus, Prophet Moses. Sharia includes doing worship, like prayer and fasting, and making the pilgrimage to Mecca, and giving charity, and taking care of our neighbors, taking care of the poor, taking care of the minorities. Religious freedom of expression, freedom of religion, it's all part of Sharia. So if we were to say that I'm not following Sharia, we are essentially saying that we are not Muslims.
Larif is on the board of directors for the Islamic Circle of North America. This national organization is working with local mosques and Islamic groups to educate the public about Sharia through billboards, radio spots, and a toll-free Ask a Muslim hotline. Larif says the anti-Sharia laws are not just a danger to Muslims, they undermine the religious freedom of all Americans.
The campaign that we are trying to do is not only to defend the religious freedom of the Muslims, but to defend the religious freedom of all Americans. We stand in solidarity with all other faith groups, with all other religious leaders, to protect our faith.
Muslims believe that Sharia was given to them by God through Muhammad and by later Muslim scholars. The rules and guidelines of Sharia are laid out in the Quran and the Sunnah, which is the teaching by example of Muhammad. Sharia is the source of rules many Muslims follow, which forbid alcohol, gambling, and pork. But it's more than just a list of do's and don'ts. It actually describes the Muslim way to deal with just about any situation life might throw at you. It describes how followers should settle conflicts, conduct business, get married, get divorced, and write wills. In their private lives, many Muslim Americans have developed ways to follow Sharia in a non-Sharia society.
In Islam, interest is prohibited. We cannot take interest or give interest. So today in the United States, we have provisions available for a Muslim to take mortgages from banks that are Islamic. These banks don't deal with interest. And Muslims, they get loans from them and they write contracts with them which are non-interest based. They call it Sharia-compliant financing, meaning that there is no interest in that financing.
Most of Sharia practice is limited to pretty mundane day-to-day activities. But a lot of the general public is still concerned about Sharia, and that's understandable, especially considering the way it's portrayed in the media. Many argue the rights of individuals are neglected and that women receive unfair treatment under Sharia. In divorce, for example, men have more options than women. In some interpretations of Sharia, a husband is permitted to beat a wife who fails to fulfill her responsibilities. The penal codes, which call for severe punishment of certain crimes, have also drawn a lot of attention. KU Law Professor Raj Bala, who teaches Sharia, explains the punishment for stealing.
That is a crime which is a crime against God, a claim of God, a crime against the religion. And the punishment that is, it's known in Arabic as haq Allah crime. And there are a limited number of haq Allah offenses. And they are seen as the most serious offenses that one can commit, triggering the most serious punishments. And these punishments are generally, not all of them, but generally spelled out in the Quran. And sarika happens to be one of them, theft, where after the first offense, the right hand would be cut off, and then the second offense would be left foot, and then thereafter it would be imprisonment or flogging.
However, of the 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, very few are actually interested in seeing Sharia carried out literally in their governments or in their communities.
The most Muslims would agree that these offenses, while serious, of course, the punishments for them need to and have been interpreted in a different way so as not to trigger that strict cutting off of a limb. And when you also look at polls of Muslims around the world, including the Arab Muslim world, most of them would not want the most severe forms of Islamic criminal law to be their own law.
And there are actually a very small number of places in the world where the most severe practices of Sharia are carried out as the law of the land.
A tiny minority of countries and jurisdictions actually impose such punishments. There are roughly 57 countries in the Organization of Islamic Conference, and really the three where these punishments might be imposed, depending on the case, would be the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the parts of Somalia where al-Shabaab is in control. I guess a fourth one you could add is some of the northern Nigerian states.
The way people practice Sharia often has as much to do with their personal choice and culture as with the writings of Islam. Muhammad lived about 1,400 years ago, and the way Muslims translate his teachings to modern times is the cause of a lot of debate. Some fundamentalists take all the teachings literally. Some take them as metaphor. Bala says that Christians can relate by looking at their own faith.
In the New Testament, the word of God, the Son of God, Jesus, is that if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. That is the literal word of God accepted by Christians, that it's the Son of God, it's Jesus speaking. He's saying, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Is the literal word of God interpreted literally? No. The Christian world does not interpret that literally. Otherwise, a lot of us, myself included, would be cutting off our own hands because they have caused us to sin in the past.
But in the past years, fundamentalist and radical Muslims have been making their voices heard around the world. Since the start of the Arab Spring, the Muslim world has seen the rise in influence of Islamists in a few countries like Egypt and Tunisia. These politicians are pushing to make Sharia the law of the land in their countries. In the United States, courts have seen a few cases in which rapists or murderers have tried to justify their violence by claiming that they're acting in accordance with Sharia. UMKC Law Professor Rana Lehr-Linhart, who also specializes in Sharia, explains one of the most famous of these recent cases, which went to court in 2009.
It's SD versus MJR, but in that case, there's a young woman who is married. She's from Morocco, and shortly after her marriage, her husband asked her to cook food and different things, and she didn't know how to do it. She didn't do it right. And so when the guests left, according to her testimony, according to the case, he beat her and then he raped her. And this happened again and again and again. When the imam testified, the religious leader testified, he said, well, yes, under Islam, a woman must be sexually available to her husband. So when it first went to court, the judge in the family division held that there was no criminal sexual contact, that there was no rape, because the husband and the imam testified, well, under Islam, a man can always demand sex from his wife. And so there was no criminal intent. So the judge in the family court basically held that the husband was not guilty of sexual assault and criminal sexual contact.
Anti-Sharia activists point to this case as proof that the U.S. needs laws which would bar courts from considering Sharia. However, that's not the end of the New Jersey case. In 2010, the decision was appealed.
In the Superior Court of New Jersey Appellate Division, the appellate court held that the trial court had erred because the trial court focused on, well, his religion didn't prohibit that practice. But under the law does prohibit that. Under U.S. law, the law does prohibit it. And it doesn't matter that under Sharia, under his religious law, that those actions were not prohibited. And therefore, the husband was found to have committed sexual assault and criminal sexual contact.
The First Amendment of the Constitution allows Americans to practice their religion, but that freedom ends when it comes to breaking U.S. laws. When the New Jersey court decided to enforce Sharia instead of U.S. law, it violated one of the most basic tenets of the Constitution, the Supremacy Clause. Raj Bala explains.
Under our American constitutional structure, it is not possible for a judge to ground a holding in his or her opinion based on law other than that of the United States or of his or her state. Judge cannot say, I am right, I am reaching this result because of something that is said in the Quran or something that the Prophet Muhammad said.
But by 2011, the momentum of anti-Sharia couldn't be stopped. Among the many bills that came up in state legislatures last year, the most successful was in Oklahoma. 70% of voters approved a bill that would ban courts from enforcing Sharia or any foreign law. The new law stunned Oklahoma's 10,000 Muslims, including Munir Awad, who had written a Sharia-based will. He was concerned that even though his will complied entirely with Oklahoma law, it might still be invalidated simply because it was based on Sharia. Rana Lehr-Linhart explains that Munir Awad fought back.
He challenged the law in federal district court, and I'm reading some of this from the Tenth Circuit opinion. He objected to the amendment singling out his religion for negative treatment. He claims the amendment's implementation would cause multiple adverse consequences, such as stigmatizing him and others who practice the Muslim faith, inhibiting the practice of Islam, disabling a court from probating his last will and testament, which contains references to Sharia law, and limiting the relief Muslims can obtain from Oklahoma state courts and fostering excessive entanglement between the government and his religion. So he went to federal district court, and then the district court, in fact, granted a preliminary injunction.
The injunction was upheld on January 10th of this year, and the case will go next to federal district court, where its merits will be heard. Muslims and First Amendment advocates will finally get their chance to challenge anti-Sharia legislation, and they have cause to be optimistic, because the chance of a law that specifically mentions Sharia actually staying on the books is very slim. KU constitutional law professor Richard Levy explains.
I would say highly likely that a law that targeted a religion would be considered unconstitutional. Under the Supreme Court's case law, the law might be upheld if it were to be narrowly tailored to meet a compelling governmental interest. So if the government could show that there was a very, very strong interest, like protecting millions of lives and things like that, or other similarly important interests, and then that the law targeting the religion was really necessary in order to avoid that harm or serve that compelling interest, it might survive constitutional scrutiny. But I'm not aware of any case where the U.S. Supreme Court has said that a law targeting a religion or a religious practice was constitutional.
In Missouri, 2011 saw three different bills that would have affected Sharia. But the most successful of these didn't even mention Sharia by name. House Bill 708, sponsored by Representative Paul Kirtman, would have simply banned the courts from enforcing any foreign law, and that would have included Sharia. The bill received a lot of attention, especially in St. Louis, where it drew protest from Muslim groups and the local ACLU chapter. Others questioned the impact such a broadly worded law could have on international trade. Still, the bill passed through the House. Time ran out in last year's legislative session before the bill could come up for a vote in the Senate. This year, Paul Kurtman is back with a slightly revised message.
Our Constitution protects people's rights to be Muslim or to be Baptist like me, or to be Catholic or to be Jewish. And I think that this bill that I'm introducing goes a long way to make sure that people's religious freedoms are protected. This new bill that I have, we went a long way from the bill that I introduced last year.
His new bill, 1512, builds on last year's bill with several new clauses, including one which states that it could not be used to limit free exercise of religion.
I had three Muslims actually come into my office and to talk to me about this particular bill, and once I explained the whole thing to them, they didn't see it as a threat to their faith. Since this bill only prohibits judges from acknowledging laws that would infringe upon somebody's civil liberties, a Muslim could practice Sharia law all they want. A Catholic can practice the religious mandates of what his church teaches.
Asked about the need for the law, Kurtman cites an incident from 2011 when three Gibson guitar facilities in Tennessee were raided by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Department for supposedly possessing illegally exported Indian wood. Kurtman says he wants the government to protect U.S. interest by making sure U.S. law is recognized as superior to foreign laws, though he acknowledges this is already how the law is written.
The Constitution is set up like this, but I think you can agree with me that people in government don't always follow the law. You know, they're not everybody in government, whether it's in the court system or in Congress or Jefferson City, not everybody is always there to do the right thing. I think that probably most of the citizens in Missouri and probably America would agree that we have people in government that probably shouldn't be there because they're misusing their platform or their position of authority.
The Kansas Senate is also currently considering a bill 2087 that would reestablish the supremacy of U.S. law while protecting free exercise of religion. For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith.
Coming up, a documentary about the political club Freedom Incorporated. You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Free health clinics have long been caring for people who have no health coverage and limited resources to pay for private care. That's why services are free. Well, mostly. As KCUR's Alana Gordon reports, a down economy and growing demand has many clinics, including a Kansas City mainstay, reassessing.
At 7:59 in the morning, the waiting room of the Kansas City Free Health Clinic is empty and quiet. But all that changes once 8 a.m. hits.
Good morning, Kansas City Free Health Clinic.
That's when Angela Stallings, who sits behind the check-in counter, starts scheduling appointments for the next day.
Uh-huh, you're welcome. Bye-bye. Good morning, Kansas City Free Health Clinic.
The clinic is one of the few places in town where you're not charged anything for services. The place prides itself on being founded by a group of hippies. I know this firsthand from having worked there for a few years before becoming a reporter. So, these appointments are highly coveted spots for a growing number of people who don't have any public or private health coverage and are out of other options. They get booked fast.
Today, I think it took me about 30 to 45 minutes.
To fill up how many appointments?
It was probably about 100.
That's a lot of phone calls.
A lot. And they still come and come and come. Good morning, Kansas City Free Health Clinic.
Since the recession hit, a record number of people have been turning to the Kansas City Free Health Clinic for care. 16,000 last year. The volume of clinic services spiked 40%. Meanwhile, funding from private donations and fundraisers, which helps pay for things like keeping the lights on, dropped. The clinic recently scaled back its medication dispensary program and now refers most patients to outside pharmacies for $4 prescriptions instead of providing them on-site for free. The clinic made another noticeable change recently, too.
If you have any, and also we're asking for a $10 donation.
In case you missed it, Stallings asked for a $10 donation. The clinic started doing this last fall. There are now signs posted at the front desk and on the door of the waiting room. The clinic even put in credit card machines.
I don't mind being asked, and if we have it, you know, if anybody has it, they should be able to give it.
53-year-old Patricia Pikey is one of the first people to check in for an appointment this morning. She's been coming here for her high blood pressure and chronic back pain since she was laid off from a JCPenney outlet store a couple years ago. Peggy doesn't have any money today, but says the $10 request doesn't bother her. She sends something in when she can.
Because these people come in and they see you, and it's on their own free time. And I totally appreciate it. Totally. I wouldn't be able to get medical help without it.
Not everyone's comfortable with the change.
Amy?
Amy Uginen is here to have her diabetes checked. Uginen's been coming to the clinic since she lost health coverage 6 years ago. She was surprised when the clinic started asking for a $10 fee. Says it's humiliating.
People come here because they don't have money. So asking for it up front is a little bit off-putting.
Dr. Craig Dietz is the clinic's medical director. He treats patients and works with hundreds of medical volunteers who help staff the clinic. He says in some ways, nothing's really changed.
This clinic was really started on individual people making donations and donations of time.
Dr. Dietz says the clinic has always asked patients to donate.
It's just become more important that we actually ask. A lot of free clinics have been really just passive about it and just waiting and hoping, just having a box out for donations.
The clinic's not alone in requesting a fee from patients.
Across the country, we're seeing more and more clinics are having to do this, because the donations that were coming in this economy just aren't there.
Nicole Lamriel Busby is director of the National Association of Free and Charitable Health Clinics, which represents about 1,200 clinics nationwide. She says the strain of the economy is being felt everywhere.
We have seen a 40 to 50% increase in patient demand at our clinics across the country and a 20 to 30% decrease in donations, meaning that all of our clinics have to do so much more with less.
And whereas before the recession, about half of free clinics didn't charge anything, now Lamriel Busby says about 5 in 6 clinics request a patient fee. But at least in this region, the Kansas City Free Health Clinic may have been a rarity to begin with. Heather Folk is the director of Duchesne Clinic in Kansas City, Kansas.
Our patients have always been asked to pay something for care. It's been $15 since, I believe, 2001. Prior to that, earlier, it may have been $10.
Her clinic's not alone. There's only a handful of nonprofit clinics in the area that don't charge anything or request a specific donation. Federally designated community health centers like SWOPE have a sliding fee for people who are uninsured. Folks says for her clinic, donations don't make up a huge part of the budget, but they've always had an important purpose.
It encourages the patients to take responsibility in their care. It doesn't deter, as again, we never turn anyone away because they can't pay.
Back in the waiting room of the Kansas City Free Health Clinic, James Hughes is here for the first time. He says a $10 donation doesn't faze him.
Compared to the price of insurance, it's a generous donation to be seen by a doctor.
And he says it sure beats his medical bill from last year, when he was without his blood pressure medication and wound up in the emergency room.
I think it came up to like $675 or something like that. With all the tests, EKGs, and whatever.
Have you been able to pay the bill off?
Somewhat. I'm still paying.
The clinic says whether or not Hughes and other patients are able to pay $10 has no effect on their access to care. There's no bill, either. But throughout the country, the existence of a totally free health clinic now appears to be something of the past. Alana Gordon, KCUR News.
This story is part of a reporting partnership that includes KCUR, NPR, and Kaiser Health News. If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. Kansas City has now had 2 African-American mayors and black elected officials in city, county, and state government. But this progress didn't happen by chance. A new film by Emil Cleaver called Freedom Now documents the history of the nation's oldest African-American political organization, Freedom Incorporated. It's a story of how the black community organized to battle racism, organized crime, and intimidation in a fierce fight for political representation. Emil Cleaver's name might sound familiar. He is the son of former mayor and current congressman Emmanuel Cleaver. He joined Susan in the studio to talk about his film.
Well, I was taking a master's class at UMKC, the Kansas City Black Experience, and we had to write a paper on an organization or a person dealing with Black history in Kansas City, and I decided to write a paper on Freedom Incorporated. And when I started doing research, I couldn't find anything. There wasn't enough information out there to write a paper. So I decided to do a documentary. I felt that Freedom was an important organization and there needed to be some type of documentation out there to let future generations know about Freedom.
I imagine you probably had some experiences as a youth with Freedom. What were some of your memories of Freedom as a youth, and what kinds of things were you involved in?
As a youngster, I really wasn't interested in doing any of the canvassing or anything, but my brother and I were involved at a young age. We would go out and pass out flyers and things like that, go door to door, talk to people about voting. And I was just, we were just little kids, but as I got older, I saw the importance of an organization like Freedom. But as a youngster, I really wasn't too concerned with doing all that work. I just wanted to play basketball.
Now, did you run into any obstacles getting people to participate in your video project?
No. A lot of people were excited to do it. They were excited to tell the story. I started out interviewing Mr. Fred Curls, who was the only living founding member, and a lot of members who had been around since the 60s and 70s. So I didn't really have any problem finding people to interview.
Now, the film starts kind of at the beginning in the Pendergast era, where organized crime was very prominent. And it kind of points out the connection between organized crime and politics. So I'm going to play a clip now of somebody that you know pretty well.
Many people in Kansas City, particularly young people, don't realize that Kansas City has historically been the most powerful drugs, most powerful mafia city outside of Chicago in the nation. In fact, during the heyday of the mob, Kansas City actually controlled the Las Vegas casinos. It belonged to the Kansas City family.
The picture that's painted in the documentary is a picture of African Americans who were powerless to change a political process that really didn't include them. In your research, what did you learn about that period in terms of how it affected the African American community at that time?
Well, I learned that during that period, the early 60s and before that, organized crime kind of dictated who would hold an office and represent that ward, which was predominantly African American. They used intimidation, bribery to get people elected. And at one point, Leon Jordan and Bruce Watkins ran against each other. They both lost. They canceled out each other's votes. So the organized crime candidate won. So after that, they decided to come together and form an organization together. They knew together they were more powerful and they could get more votes. So that was how they formed. And it wasn't easy after they started to form this organization. I mean, there were organized crime members didn't want to give up that power. So they ran into a lot of difficulties.
So, Leon Jordan and Bruce Watkins, but there were five founders, right?
Well, actually, there were seven founders. There are five founders in the picture signing the documents of incorporation. Leon Jordan, Bruce Watkins, Howard Maupin, Dr. Charles Moore, and Fred Curls. The two founders who weren't in that picture are Leonard Hughes II and Marion Foote.
As you think about the founders, what qualities did they bring to the table, each of them, I'm thinking, because they each brought different skill sets that enabled them to be eventually successful against a powerful political machine?
Well, Leon Jordan was a leader. Bruce R. Watkins was charismatic. You know, he was liked by everyone. Howard Maupin owned a barbershop on Prospect, so he had access to a lot of people. So he used his connections at the barbershop to get people involved. Leonard Hughes was an attorney, so he knew the legal process to go through to get it incorporated. Now, I really didn't find out too much about Dr. Charles Moore or Marion Foote. Fred Curls, he was in real estate, so he had a lot of, I guess, connections through that.
Now, as you mentioned, change didn't come very easily because really the initial plan, as I understood it from your documentary, was to take over the 14th Ward. How bad did it get in terms of the fear and intimidation factor?
Well, I mean, I think it got pretty bad, but because they didn't back down, they were able to overcome that. But there are clips in the documentary where Bishop Tindall, who was a former president of Freedom, he talks about how the North End, which is what the mafia was called, the North End would come, pull out money and pay people to go into the polls and vote their way. So there was a lot of obstacles to overcome, but, you know, they were able to do it. And at one point, many people believe that that was the reason why Leon Jordan was killed, because they took that power away from the North End.
The documentary talks about that in 1964, there was very limited access to public accommodations. And Freedom played a role even before the Public Accommodations Act was passed. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, Freedom organized and registered voters to get public accommodations downtown. The churches were heavily involved. There were a lot of social clubs that were involved. But we were able to get public accommodations here in Kansas City 18 months before Lyndon Johnson signed the public accommodations bill in 1964. And a lot of that had to do with Freedom Incorporated.
Now, you mentioned earlier that some speculate, and actually with some of the new findings about the murder of Leon Jordan, I think they were correct, that standing up to organize crime meant paying a price and that his murder may have had something to do with it. In your research, how did his death affect Freedom?
Well, I think it made him stronger. You know, everyone that I talked to about that said that after that, it really kind of brought them together and made them stronger. Bruce Watkins took over after that, and they just continued to grow. Actually, after his death, Freedom Incorporated became more powerful. His death was a blow, of course, to Freedom, but really it just made him stronger.
Now, most of the movers and shakers in early Freedom were men, which was interesting. Why do you think that was? And I guess the second part of my question is, what roles did women play in Freedom and getting political clout in the community?
I can only guess that the reason that the men were the most prominent figures is because it was a different period, the 1960s. And I guess women were still kind of fighting for certain rights. But there were women involved. Like I said, Marion Foote was one of the founders. Rosemary Lowe was around since the beginning. Edith Haney Galvin was actually the first president of Young Freedom. And Young Freedom was started shortly after Freedom was formed. And it was a group of young people that were kind of groomed to be politicians or leaders in the community. And that was headed by Mr. Fred Curls.
Now, some of those young people back then are people's names that we would recognize today as elected officials, right?
Right. Phil Curls, who was a state senator, Archie Welch, who was a former president, Harold Doc Holliday was on the city council as well as a state representative, and also Charles Hasley, who was on the city council for 20 years, I believe. He was involved with Young Freedom.
Once Freedom was able to gain ground in terms of organizing the black community, and I know they had control over more and more wards, what were some of the accomplishments, let's say, in the 80s, 90s, and beyond?
Well, they were able to get a lot of judges appointed, which was a big deal, of course. They were able to get the first African-American elected as mayor. They were also able to get Alan Wheat elected as a United States congressman, and which was in a predominantly white district. So those were some of the biggest accomplishments. They were able to work with Senator Tom Eagleton and a lot of other people. At one point during the 80s and early 90s, every politician really needed Freedom's endorsement to get elected. They were known for winning elections. And, you know, if a candidate lost an election, it was because they didn't get the votes outside of the Freedom Wards, because Freedom, they got the people organized and they got those votes.
Well, you know, which begs a question. Freedom was very powerful in getting black elected officials elected. And yet we fast forward to now and we have a black mayor that got elected, I think, without the help of Freedom. I mean, I know he wasn't endorsed initially by Freedom. Thoughts about that?
Well, yeah, it's a different period. Freedom is still a strong organization, but they're not probably as strong as they used to be because a lot of those people have moved out to the suburbs. I mean, at one point, you know, pretty much all the African Americans were in one area. So they kind of needed Freedom, and Freedom became strong because of that. But now, you know, we have people out in Grandview, Raytown, and all these suburbs, and it kind of, I think, hurt Freedom's political clout. And yeah, the mayor wasn't originally endorsed by Freedom, I believe, not in the primary, but in the general election he was.
Speaking of that kind of challenge, you know, that the base, if you will, has moved kind of to the first tier suburbs, how do you think Freedom will meet that kind of challenge since things have changed?
Well, I asked a lot of people that, and they think that the key is to get younger people involved, college students, to get them involved in the political process, just like when they first started with Young Freedom. And I think they need to reach out to the suburbs as well, maybe set up some type of base in the suburbs to connect with those people. But I think the key is getting younger people involved, letting them know about the history, because a lot of people are living in an era where they see a black mayor and they don't know the struggles that it took to get him elected, or seeing a congressman and they don't know the struggles that it took to make that happen. So letting them know about our history and kind of teaching them, grooming them to be leaders in the community.
How do you respond to critics who might say, well, the film on Freedom paints a rosy picture, a very complimentary picture of an organization without talking about its flaws? And some of the flaws have been public.
Right. You know, there is I've heard that already from people who haven't seen the film. But I don't have a problem with that. You know, Freedom is an important organization, period. They have done a lot of things to help African-Americans in Kansas City. So I wanted to point those things out. There are a lot of leaders, historical figures who have done great things, and people don't point out their flaws. I mean, we just celebrated a person who a national holiday of a person who fits that example. And the reason is they've done more good than they've done bad. So I wanted to point that out. And this is the first work done about Freedom. So the first historical account of this organization, I wanted to point out the positive things that they've done. Now, in the future, I'm sure that someone will talk about the good and the bad. But I wanted to point out the good that they've done.
That was Emil Cleaver, filmmaker and owner of Davenport Media and Film. His documentary, Freedom Now, will premiere on Friday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library.
After the break, the last of our Server Tell All series, where we hear about Kansas City dining, from the waiter's perspective. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Next Saturday, a 100-year-old tradition will come to an end, a competition that some say has roots in the Civil War era. KC is ground zero for the college rivalry known as the Border War between the University of Kansas and the University of Missouri. At the end of the school year, Mizzou leaves the Big 12 for the Southeastern Conference, or the SEC.
Whether you're a Jayhawk or a Tiger or have no dog in the fight, there's been no escaping the sometimes friendly, sometimes ugly banter between fans. Now just days away from the last men's basketball game these two may ever play, we wondered how fans were holding up. Casey Currents' Carrie Coogan stopped in at Governor Stumpy's, a neighborhood restaurant in Waldo, during a Missouri game last week and found plenty of fans from both sides of the state line.
My name is Sue, and I'm a KU fan. I hate to see it disappear because it's been around forever. Of course, I was born and raised in Kansas, so I wouldn't cheer for Missouri for anything.
And you left town, and KU's going to kick some behind. Show them who's the big dog now. My name is Pat, and I was an MU fan. Now I'm a KU fan. It's working with the guys when Missouri loses. These guys actually cry at work, grown men. You cannot even talk to them because they're still sobbing over the ball game. But then when they win, you can't get a word in.
Those games started playing in 1890, and I understand the whole historical perspective of it. My name is Jeffrey M. Goodwin, and I am a Tiger. Time to move on, and we have to change and do what's best for our university, and the best thing for our university right now is to move to the SEC.
My name is Andy Garrison, and I'm a Jayhawk fan. Crimson and blue, baby. I'll miss, winning a six-pack of beer from my friend Chris, every time KU beats MU. But hey, he's a Tiger fan, and I guess I can say one of my best friends is a Tiger.
It is a sports rivalry, but, it's gone on since, the Civil War, so I'm sure it'll still be there. It just probably won't be as entertaining anymore.
My name is Monica, and not that I follow college sports a whole lot, but when it comes down to Missouri versus Kansas, Missouri, every time.
Brent Ryan, KU fan. Does feel like a little kid who doesn't want to play anymore, and they're their marbles, and they're just going to just take their marbles and go home. And then the other person sitting there like, well, wait a minute, I still wanted to play. I'm not upset.
Missouri has always been looked at as lesser than, but at the end of the day, it was Missouri that had options, and Kansas didn't, and it really makes them angry.
My name's Chris, and I'm a Mizzou guy. If Kansas wants to play, we'll make room for them. If they don't, we'll have plenty to do. I think that's what makes it a great rivalry, is it's genuine dislike. And if you get a chance to get rid of somebody you really don't like, do you miss them?
Hi, my name is Jeffrey McDaniel. I am a Missouri Tiger fan. This city is a divided city by state line. It gets old, the division. This game heightens that whole division between the two states. I'm very sick of that division, and I'm hoping that with Missouri going to the SEC and Kansas staying with the Big 12 and this game kind of going away, we can all kind of get along.
That's it for Casey Currents this week. This show will be archived online with all of our past shows at kcur.org.
Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org, or if you're into Twitter, follow us at kcurrents.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producer Alex Smith. Kayla Regan and Carrie Coogan are interns. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.